Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. The date is August 9th, 2021. It's Monday. You're listening to The Drop.
Like David said at the top, it is Monday, August 9th. Welcome back to The Drop. I am Brian Brinkman. I am very excited to be sitting down and hanging out with all of you this week. Coming off of about 10 days of a road trip around the southwestern United States, I'm feeling invigorated with where I've chosen to live during this period in my life. I'm loving music right now. My kids are about to start actual childcare in the next 2 weeks. Pretty much everything in my life is going well right now. I feel pretty good. How are you doing, Dave?
That's a pretty enthusiastic intro. Give me some of that. I'm doing good. And Sunday, provided my whole family is healthy, which they appear to be, we are going to go to Cape Cod for a week. So you know how like in the past there'd be episodes of Beyond the Pond recorded and I was like sunburnt and maybe a little hungover in Cape Cod? Well, there's going to be an episode of The Drop recorded in the Cape. We haven't stayed at this house before, so I'm assuming hopefully the Wi-Fi is pretty good. Otherwise, we might have a bit of a problem. But I'm looking forward to that, even though, as most parents would agree, it's not a real vacation unless it's without your children. I could use a change of scenery. So looking forward to getting that done.
Yeah, I'm like I said, I'm coming off of 10 days. We drove from Denver down through southern Utah, through Vegas to Southern California, where my brother-in-law and his family live in Santa Barbara. And then we visited with my wife's aunt and uncle in Westlake Village. Kids were there. There was a lot of swimming, a lot of beach time, a lot of hanging out. It was very much needed. And then we found out 2 days before we drove back to Denver that there had been mudslides in Glenwood Springs, which is basically an hour into your drive in Colorado, and it was going to reroute us a significant amount. So we said, you know what? Let's just take the southern route. We'll drive through Arizona. We'll go see the Grand Canyon. It's my first time seeing the Grand Canyon. Feels like a perfect summer, family summer road trip where we go see the Grand Canyon and one of the kids is afraid of heights. The baby is crying. The kid sees a bus that he wants a toy of. We don't know if they actually have a toy of it. We snap a few pictures at the Grand Canyon. Dad stands over it being like, oh my God, I cannot believe how small we are. How was something like this created? All the while his family's dragging him away. It was perfect. It was like a... It was like a Griswold scene. I was like so enamored with the Grand Canyon. It was like, I felt like I was seeing, you know, this like spiritual moment of like understanding Earth's formation and Earth's evolution in a completely new way, all while being dragged away by my family. And then we drove up through Durango and back to Denver. So we got like a really cool circle from Denver south and then back up. And, it was perfect, man. So I'm on a little bit of a high. It's August. It is a family vacation time, and you're about to go to the Cape, which is a good time for you, I know, every year.
Yes, we are. Quick baseball chatter. As we have predicted in the last episode, there were many Cubs in many places, and the Mets ended up with Javier Baez, flashy guy. Hits, does incredible things in the base path, hits a lot of home runs, strikes out a lot, too. So, like, the Javi Baez experience, one recent game, he made an incredibly nifty slide at home plate to score a run. He hit a home run. People were being like, it's Javi magic. And then the next game, he proceeded to strike out five times. It's hard to do. And leave eight men on base. So basically, that's the yin and yang of the Javi experience. And Brian tells me he wouldn't have it any other way.
I wouldn't. I mean, some of the biggest moments in Cubs history came via Javi Baez's bat. The man has so much confidence, and he knows how to just make magic happen when it needs to happen. I will trade that magic for the five strikeouts in a game for swinging outside on a pitch that's like 3 feet off the plate every time. I enjoyed it all. He's a bit of a freed swinger. He gave me that 2018 season, man. He should have won the MVP and was absolutely incredible throughout the entire season. The bright spot on a very frustrating 2018 season for the Cubs.
Baseball is always a good thing, but this is also basketball free agency. And the Knicks are about to acquire Kemba Walker, who's basically the first real point guard they've had since George W. Bush was in office. And he is a University of Connecticut Husky hero. So I'm going to get the rare opportunity to root for a member of my favorite college basketball team on my favorite pro team. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah, I'm coming off of my first good Bulls summer since 2014.
Hot Bulls summer?
Yeah, Hot Bulls summer. Basically, since we lost in the second round to the Cavaliers in 2015 on a team that I absolutely loved, the Bulls have been a clusterfuck. I mean, just a total dumpster fire for the last 6 or 7 years. Trading away Jimmy Butler for Zach LaVine. I don't want to go too deep on the pod. I could go on for the entire episode. I am not a fan of Zach LaVine as our number one. I am open to the experience with the guys that we have put around him, and I'm interested to see what this upcoming season presents for the Bulls. But I'm very skeptical. I think that we just pushed a lot of chips in the middle of the table for Lonzo Ball, DeMar DeRozan, and a Zach LaVine combo, Alex Caruso as well in there. I do like that pickup quite a bit. I did love the Lonzo signing. The DeMar DeRozan just is weird to me, and it feels like we pushed everything in the middle for like maybe the seventh seed, and that just doesn't seem worth it to me. But hey, what do I know? I do trust our new GM, and I'm willing to see where this goes over the next year. And we kind of had to do something or else we're going to lose LaVine, and he's our biggest asset right now. So we'll see what happens. But I'm excited. I feel like Bulls and Knicks games, whenever they mean something, it's a lot more fun for me watching basketball. And watching like an exciting Bulls-Knicks game, even if it's like, yeah, but both of these teams are 6 or 7 seeds, I think it's still going to be a good thing.
Shifting gears, Fish has played 6 shows at the on summer tour. At the time we're recording this, they're about to hit the stage in Deer Creek in about 45 minutes, so not going to keep ourselves too long. But in brief, well, first of all, let me say, you guys, we have a treat for you on the drop. Me and Brian are going to talk a little Fish, but the large discussion portion, this is actually going to be taken up by a discussion I had with our good friend, our brother in the Great White North, Scotty King. He's been on Beyond the Pond in the past. He's a great dude. He's also a musician who's going to give us kind of what he saw, a musician's perspective on the first six shows of Phish Tour. It was a very nice 15-minute conversation, and we are going to get to that in a bit. But first, I will say that Arkansas gave me a bit of pause, but they probably shook off the rust faster than I've ever seen in any Phish Tour 3.0, or I guess this being 4.0, because like the leap from Arkansas to the Oak Mountain show was quite significant, and they haven't really let up since.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think in hindsight, I'm willing to give them a benefit of the doubt. Like, you know, just scratch Arkansas as like they needed to play a first gig. It's their first time in that state. I'm sure that they were a little spooked taking the stage, just knowing what's happening around the country with cases rising so rapidly.
Yeah, definitely.
Also hadn't played together in a while, you know, incorporating. The thing that's so crazy about Phish is like, you would think they'd almost give themselves like an ease in and basically utilize the same gear from a year ago. And instead Trey has overhauled his rig completely. Paige has moved his synthesizer on his overall rig. And it just seems like they're trying to incorporate a completely new sound and style into the mix, which had probably some impact on the overall apprehension that they sounded like they played with in Arkansas. That said, I did not hear a lot of these shows live because I was kind of busy on a family trip. So I would spend a lot of the evenings just getting text messages from Dave and our friend Josh Carver. Shout out Josh Carver, NOLA Sox, talking about the shows as they were going along. And I could kind of follow along with their excitement as the shows happened. And then I went back and listened and was like, okay, yeah. Like almost immediately at Oak Mountain, they sound like a different band. Like the Sigma Oasis, third time they've ever played it, fourth time maybe, completely owning that song, playing it live with total confidence. And that's just like a song that's going to go 7 minutes. The jamming beyond that, the Carini at Oak Mountain, the Chalk Dust Torture and Tweezer at Alpharetta, and the entire second set on the second night at Nashville really just showcased a band that is both really curious right now, feeling really adventurous, and communicating with each other almost immediately. And those three things just excite the hell out of me.
Yeah, the Alpharetta Tweezer kind of sounds like you're walking down the street in 1973 and every car is just blaring like the funkiest shit out and you're just strutting. There is like the last 5 minutes of that are just insane in terms of like the levers of deep funk and the Paige Moog. Just fit, and in between it was like it was effortless. I mean, I've been listening to a lot of these jams on the elliptical machine at the gym in the basement of my apartment building, and I've when Phish is good, I lose a lot of weight. I was like doing jazz hands, doing like an imaginary like lasso while like some like 75-year-old men like looked down at me on the elliptical thinking, what the fuck is this guy doing on that Alpharetta Tweezer? That's something to behold. That's a jam I'm going to be able to save for the rest of my life.
Yeah, agree. And you're so on the nose, like the last 10 or excuse me, the last 5 minutes being so funky. I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but like the only time in their career that they would just like tack on a funk riff jam like that was like
Fall 97,
yeah. Summer Fall 97, where they were like, okay, we're just going to take this out for a walk. And it was around that sort of theme. So two shows later, that second set of Nashville, you know, I feel like they took a lot of the lessons from the Alpharetta Tweezer. And even I would say from the Alpharetta Chalk Dust and the Pelham Carini and applied them across an entire set.
Yeah.
And I found that really fascinating, where even when they found outs into new songs, think specifically like the Ghost Jam, you know, if I wanted to nitpick in any sort of way, that jam could have gone on for 5 or 6 minutes longer for me. But the segue into, and this is not a complaint, like the segue into Bathtub Gin was so smooth. It was so perfect. It was so on point. And then they incorporated aspects of the Ghost Jam in Bathtub Gin that you felt like you were hearing Bathtub Gin within a Ghost Jam. And like that sort of fusion together reminds me so much of 2.0 Fish.
With the Mr. Completely Drum Fills.
With the Mr. Completely Drum Fills, totally. Where like, you know, they're not necessarily playing sloppily. They're just like letting the conventional edges of where a song begins and ends kind of blur to the side. And they're coming into the song in sort of like a smooth way, but also, you know, I don't know if I'd say rough, but like it's kind of discombobulated, but in like a really pleasurable way to listen to. And it just sounds like they're just like tumbling into a song at that point. And I felt like, you know, you hear the Tweezer jam, 33 minutes. That jam had end points 3 or 4 times. Like they did the peak around 20 minutes, could have ended there. There was a point around 13 minutes where they could have faded out into like Prince Caspian. Totally cool. But they just kept going. And that's where you get that last 10 minutes. It's just like bonkers music. And I felt like you got that across the entirety of Nashville set two.
Let me ask you, if Fish was a baseball team and tour ended today, would they be in the playoffs?
Yeah, 100%. They're having one of those seasons that's they just like race out the gates, and then they end up with like 106 wins, and you're like
wire to wire. It's like the 1996 Cincinnati Reds.
Yes, it's like the 2016 Cubs, the 2018 Sox. I don't know how this is going to end. Obviously, you don't either. Like, you'll be hearing this episode after Deer Creek. That could have changed the tour, or that could solidify what we're saying. But at this point in time, yeah, I think that they're playing like a band on a complete mission.
Yeah, at this point in time, they get a first round bye. That's how good it's going. So, transitioning, as we like to do, to some big recent releases on the Osiris Podcast Network. The one I picked out came out 2 days ago. It's a podcast called Wheels Off with Rhett Miller. Of course, Rhett Miller being the longtime frontman of the long-running kind of country power pop rock group, the Old 97s, also has his own solo career in addition to many good Old 97s records. He did a discussion with Erika Wennerstrom, who is the front woman for the band The Heartless Bastards, also has one solo record which came out in 2018 called Sweet Unknown, and careful Beyond the Pond listeners will note that I fucking love that record. Seriously, yes. If you get nothing else in this podcast, go back and listen to Sweet Unknown from Erika Wennerstrom. It's kind of like an American twangy shoegaze record. Like, there's like some friggin' vistas on that album. But
it was like a War on Drugs record for 2018. Yeah. In that case. It's like, it's an American heartland record. It's amazing.
Exactly. These like awesome 9-minute like guitar epics. Just a really good album. The Heartless Bastards have a lot of good albums as well. And she's gearing to put out a new Heartless Bastards record in September. So their discussion focused a lot on, you know, what she's been doing during the pandemic, the songwriting process. Her dog named Piper was jumping onto the Zoom quite a bit, which got pretty cute, actually. But no, it was just a very interesting conversation between two excellent songwriters, excellent musicians. She sings, she has a voice like a bell, and kind of like her speaking voice isn't that far removed from her singing voice, so it was very pleasant to listen to. And just like a lot of Osiris podcasts, just happen to be musicians engaging like other musicians in ways that they really just like only know how. So I would say if you're not interested in Heartless Bastards or Erika Wennerstrom, you probably should be. And this podcast gives a pretty good example as to why.
Yeah, Wheels Off is an excellent podcast. And I agree with you, like the point you made about the perspective that a musician interviewing another musician can have. It's just fascinating to hear, like the way Rhett can get to songwriting and inspiration and whatnot in a really cool way. I am going with the latest episode of Broke Down Pod. Broke Down Pod is hosted by Jonathan Hart, who is a part of the larger Undermine team, as well as the Helping Friendly podcast team. He's hosting our weekly show, HF Pod on Tour. His episode of Broke Down Pod was with Dave Harrington, who plays with a number of artists that I absolutely love, including Nicholas Jarre in the duo Darkside. He's played with Chris Forsyth before. He's played with J-Rad. He also runs the Dave Harrington Group, which I spoke about all of this in last week's The Drop in reference to the latest Darkside album, Spiral. Dave and John get into an awesome conversation about Dave's inspirations in music, the rabbit holes that he goes down super easily from a musical standpoint. He's currently reading, at least at time of recording that episode, Thelonious Monk's biography, and found that that just like threw him down this crazy rabbit hole of jazz, which led him into music in the 70s, which led him into crazy drummers, which has like completely reshaped the way that he's been thinking about and writing music. They also talk a lot about the Grateful Dead, as it is a Grateful Dead podcast. Dave got into the Grateful Dead via Dick's Picks Volume 7. Careful listeners of 36 from the Vault will know is the September 74 European volume from the Grateful Dead. It's a fantastic volume, and it kind of reminded me of I got into the Grateful Dead via Dick's Picks 36. Someone gave it to me, listened to it, and it just completely blew my mind and opened me up to what the Dead were really capable of as a band. So listening to the conversation was really cool, kind of brought me back to early days, getting into the Dead. And then obviously, like in so many great Broke Down Pod episodes, they play a bunch of Grateful Dead. This time, some samples from September 74, including a really cool Sea Stones into the start of Playing in the Band, which was pretty wild to hear how they found Playing in the Band from Sea Stones. So highly recommend Broke Down Pod, Dave Harrington episode. All Broke Down Pods are great. I love the way that Jonathan talks about the Grateful Dead. So highly, highly recommend you listening to that if you have not.
And now we're just going to transition to my conversation with Scotty King. He's a bearded dad, just like us. Very nice guy with some very good perspective on tour. And then when we come back, we'll talk about some new records and some summer albums. All right, folks, so I'm actually sitting here with a very good friend of the pod, Scotty King. He's a brother from another mother from Canada, our friend from the Great White North. He's been in a band for a very long time. We kind of just wanted to touch base with him to get some ideas of what he's thought of Fish Tour so far, if he's had any ideas, any sort of like perspective, that of a musician. We'll just kind of let him take it from here, so... How you doing, Scotty?
I'm great, Dave. How about yourself?
Not too bad. And it helps that I think for the most part, other than Arkansas, which kind of had me concerned, Fish has been killing it these first 6 years of tour.
I agree. You know, it's opening a tour. Not everything's necessarily going to be a home run. But I think everybody is fairly confident that it's also not going to be a disaster, which is always your first relief. Night one, maybe a little bit jittery, but even night one, you know, they were just kind of finding their legs, kind of finding their sounds, finding their samples, as the case may be, depending on who you talk to. But there's no denying that there's some magic in the air, and definitely a few new tricks up the sleeves, or at least old tricks that are coming to light in a new way. I think everybody's bringing something a little bit different to the table. You know, I thought it was really interesting. If you follow Mike on Instagram, he was sort of talking in one of his Instagram stories about, you know, how he felt like the jamming was very meditative, and that he's sort of, you know, he's playing less to get more these days. I don't know whether it's my feeds or some of the ways that I've gotten the shows. I'd like to hear a bit more Mike these days. I feel like he's being overshadowed a little bit, but there's lots of time for him to step up and take that big leap.
It seems to me that the webcasts I've watched, the mix, Mike hasn't been quite as prominent. And you go back and listen to
the official soundboard recording of live fish is mixed much higher.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's, I don't know if that's just the product of watching it on my television versus pouring into my ears, but right. You know.
Yeah. But really the couple of things I want to talk about this morning. First of all, I play a few different instruments in a few different organizations. One of the things I do is drumming. Just to sort of, you know, address the Fishman sample thing kind of early on here, you know, he's always had that there. He's always had that piece there and off to the side. But sometimes you got to do things to keep it a little fresh. And if we're talking about John Fishman here, you also want to keep things light and a little bit jokey. Now, I don't want to hear a sample dropped in my sleeve like that ever again. But since then, I would agree that the moments have been more appropriate. I think they've been even sometimes celebratory. You know, the yeah is the new woo, maybe. Who knows? Certainly, we're also talking about a man that spends half of his life in the band, in the pocket, and almost invisible. And then the dichotomy of also being a guy who's been naked with a vacuum cleaner in front of, you know, thousands of people before. So I don't think we should be too surprised that Fishman would have this kind of thing on the side of his rig and have some fun monkeying around with it. That's for sure.
I always feel the samples. I find myself putting the yas in on my couch where I think they should be. Almost kind of like having heard the horns in Susie Greenberg from the Giant Country Horns, I just automatically, my head puts those in all the time.
Absolutely.
Whereas when the band gets really funky, I'll be sitting on the couch going, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's obviously that, but really I think the two big sonic portions that the band's been playing with is we got to talk a little bit about Trey's new rig. Although, quite frankly, there's been lots of discussion about that. And I know Brian had a great interview with, is it Ryan from Trey's Guitar Rig?
Yeah.
On one of the HF Pod Lives on Osiris. They can go back and look for that. They do a great job of kind of running that down. But Trey's got a new dock. He's got a new guitar. And he's got a new amp in the Train Wreck. And that coupled with him kind of pulling out a few, you know, effects on his Line 6, his M5, is giving us that kind of growly, dirty, low sound to explore with. And I don't know about you, but like when I hear that, anything that has that sort of low growl, that really gets to me.
What is the trailer I had again exactly on the stack?
So it basically, we've got this legendary head of there's, you know, very boutique produced. And I'm not sure whether that's his wet channel or his dry channel, but he's added this thing in, and it comes with its own set of impurities that make it sort of sonically unstable in the same way that the dock is sonically unstable, which allows the user to sort of utilize feedback and what's coming through the amp in a way that gives it a completely unique and that tone that we're hearing.
I've definitely been hearing the extremely growly tone, probably never so much as in the most recent show being Wednesday night, The Ghost in Nashville. God, The Ghost into Bathtub Gin, you're getting some like deep zones. Almost, God, I think of like Ween painting the town brown.
Yeah.
Far along, Poop Ship Destroyer. I'm like, this is a brown set.
Absolutely. That brown sound, and that leads nicely into what Paige is doing. And really what one of the big things that I want to talk about, and I think one of the things that I pointed out to you, is that Paige has changed the way that he has set up the keyboards. Now he has done this before. Generally the Baby Grand always faces toward the audience, but the keyboards that face directly toward the band and give him sort of best sight lines for jams have changed over the years. He's had his clav and his B3 Hammond organ over there before. He's actually had the synth facing that way before, but I think this year's change has really brought about a lot of the sonic things that people are picking up on that Paige is doing. And that's, he's got his Moog One facing toward Trey, and he's got his Wurlitzer facing toward Trey. And if you're watching any of the webcasts, you'll see it's kind of Both are kind of smaller units, but both are kind of bringing some really, really awesome things sonically, especially the Moog one. I mean, the Wurlitzer, he just seems to be favoring a lot more over his old Rhodes. The Rhodes is in the unenviable position of being the one that faces away from the band. He doesn't touch those as much. But now, even on things like the Water in the Sky the other night, you know, he played way more Whirly on that than he did Grand, which was unusual. But the Moog one, I think, is what makes people sit up and pay attention. It's that, you know, if you think back to the MSG tweezer back in 19, right about the 20-minute mark, is what brings in that, you know what I'm talking about, that beautiful part. Still, I get goosebumps when I think about that.
Oh, yeah. I can't listen to that part without, like, floating in space. That's like that tweezer, whereas the Alpharetta tweezer is kind of like an incredible house party from 1973. The MSG 2019 tweezer is kind of like being in your own personal pool on a balcony in Hawaii with Epsom salts, just being like, I'm floating.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I'm synth sensitive. I don't know what it is, but something about whenever I hear, you know, even if you think about like what's going on with Goose these days and that Moby song, like the deep bass synth, I love synthy stuff, comes in, grabs your attention, but also just sonically changes the entire palette. What's different about what Page is doing with the Moog One now is the Moog One, you can actually depress multiple keys at a time. Whereas his old Moogs were like single key action. Now you can actually chord a bit. You can move, you know, up and down your scales a lot more, but he's using it to talk to Trey when Trey's also using his effects. And there's this interplay that goes on between the two of them now where they're just swirling these new goodies that they have in and out. And what ends up happening is like when you drop into the Gin from Nashville the other night, where that doesn't quite sound like any Gin that we've heard before from an effects perspective, right? The voices as they were talking to each other, and they're loving it. And it's dragging them into all these new territories. And that's what's gotten me really excited at the end of the day.
Right. Kind of like the parts that he'd normally play on piano, like the Gershwin bits.
Yeah.
Was all done on the Moog.
Yeah. And now he's not going to do that every time.
No.
But on a night like Nashville, where the theme was slow, molasses, low, growly, like, why not? Right. And so that kind of stuff as a longtime consumer of Phish gets you really sort of excited. I think in general, just the jams right now, like if I can speak to just, you know, a personal anecdote for a second, when my band got back together for the first time after our hiatus from the pandemic, just like everybody else, I just remember our first time sitting in the room. We do lean toward more, you know, sort of jam based stuff. We didn't stop playing for 55 minutes. And when we finally did stop, the thought was, we just looked at each other. We're like, everyone was afraid to stop because just in case they took it away from us again. And I think with Phish right now, especially with those early tentpole jams, the Carini, the Chalk Dust, the Tweezer, nobody was going to take that away from them. We're like, nope, we are going big early. And then what we got to see in Nashville now that we're comfortable back in the big jams again, I think we're going to start seeing mixing things up in the second set and being more brave, you know, for the entirety of the set. It doesn't happen all the time. We know that as fans, but when it does happen, man, we love it.
I would certainly tend to agree that the Page synth might be to me like the biggest sonic. I know he was doing a lot of that in 2019, but maybe like the ambient record he put out after, I guess, visiting Iceland had something to do with it, but he's got this Moog and he's got the Whirly. And just, I'm throwing back to like a lot of Stevie Wonder's early 70s records. Mm-hmm. Like the, what's the run? Was it Music of My Mind, Inner Visions, Talking Book, Billings' First Finale. All those are all the records that were produced by the two dudes in Tonto's Expanding Headband.
Yes.
They use all the squiggly keyboards.
Yeah.
And I hear that in there and think like, oh, okay, you know, obviously Trey's a huge Stevie Wonder fan. They wanted to cover like Inner Visions in 1994. They've played Golden Lady, but now they're really getting into the whole spirit of that like synthy funk sound.
Yeah, I've really come around on the Whirly as well. I mean, I often early on in my music career conflated the Rhodes and the Whirly and didn't really differentiate between the two, but you know, think Beck's Where It's At. That's a Wurlitzer. Think you're, you know, Supertramp, Steely Dan, lots of whirly in the 70s from there. And it just seems as if Page, it seems to be a definitive voice for him right now. It seems to be the voice that he wants to speak in when he has to sort of infill, as opposed to maybe going over to the organ or you know, even just filling in on the grand. So it'll be interesting to see whether that trend continues. I really firmly believe it's because it faces toward the band. And when you're jamming, like that combo of the one and the whirly used to be on the complete opposite side with his back facing toward the band. Well, that's no fun to be jamming with your buddies. And all of a sudden, you know, everybody's playing, you can't see what they're doing. No, you want to face them. You want to, you know, get that nod from Trey, or as the case with the Chalk Dust the other night, the hand motion,
right?
You know, which may be my favorite visual of the whole tour so far. Let's take this for a ride. So yeah, absolutely. Can't wait to see what fun lies ahead with those sounds.
Yeah, I'm very excited for Deer Creek. And Hershey will probably be peaking by Atlantic City, and then they can take a few, like 10 days off, and then they start with the Gorge. Of course, everyone's health permitting. I wish I was seeing more masks in the audience, but hey, if you're vaccinated and you're outdoors, then come what may, man.
Yeah, and you know, as a Canadian, I gotta admit, I'm a little sad, a little harder for me to get shows, but I'm not even sure, having two young kids, that's a place that I would have positioned myself. Nothing came terribly close to me. I guess Deer Creek would have been my logical show choice just from a geographical perspective. It's been a long time since I've been to Deer Creek. I think it's going to be a banger there this weekend at some point.
Very much looking forward to it. But thanks for coming on The Drop. Really, really appreciate it. Really appreciate your insight. You are always welcome here.
Hey, it's great to be back. And yeah, we'll be listening to you guys and see you out there on Couch Tour.
That was a great conversation, Dave. I learned a ton about kind of what's happening from a Page standpoint throughout this tour. It gave me some really great perspective. And Scotty King, man, always, always a good dude to have on the podcast. I'm glad that you're able to sit down with him. So like Dave said before the break, we are going to go through a new record that we recommend, as well as a classic album from the summer of 2001. Dave, what is the new record that you want to recommend to us?
So this is an album which came out last Friday. This is from an artist named Torres. That's the nom de rock of one Mackenzie Scott. And her new record is called Thirstier. It's her fifth album. I've expressed my love for her records in the past. And definitely album number five. This is her big level up. It's everything bigger. It's more louder, more rocking, more like, it's, I guess, a stab at like a big arena rock record that probably she gets often compared to PJ Harvey a lot, sort of not so much maybe in the style, more in spirit. And think of like PJ Harvey's big kind of mainstreamish rock turn, Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea. I get like a bit of that with this record. It's, she's currently in a relationship with a visual artist named Jenna Gribben, and the record is basically kind of like an ode to infatuation, being wildly in love with somebody. Especially the title track is very much an anthem in that respect. But kind of relative to her last few albums, all of which are good, this one she's just really swinging for the rafters. I believe it was produced by Rob Ellis, who's produced some PJ Harvey records in the past. And I think the song we're probably going to play for you here, Don't Go Putting Wishes in My Head, she's even commented that was her big Shania Twain cowgirl like arena song. And it very much is that. It's the kind of anthem that in the past she's, I don't know if she's tried to go for an anthem, but it's clear that's what she was going for here, and she very much achieves it. And there's a lot of other songs on the record that are similarly loud and catchy, but this sounds like it's going to be a fucking blast to hear live. And hopefully I'm going to get to see her. I think she's coming back to New York in December. So, Torres, Thirstier. Check it out. Big, loud, catchy blast of 90s-style alternative rock and roll. I know you've been here time and time again. Every man wants his name on a mountain. How many thought they'd be the one to keep your love? I know promising forever's not your thing. But now if you don't want me to go dreaming, don't spend your mornings and your evenings in my bed. If you don't want me believing that you're never gonna leave me, darling, don't go putting wishes in my head.
All right. I, too, have been digging that Torres record. I highly, highly recommend it as well. I love that. I think you got me into the earlier Torres record from 2020, early 2020, would that be correct? It was 2019.
What, you had Silver Tongue, Three Futures, the second one was called Sprinter?
I think it was Silver Tongue.
Yeah, Silver Tongue's great.
Yeah. So I want to talk about a record that is a side project for two artists that I absolutely love, who have played in larger bands I really like, and with other artists I really enjoy. The project is called Yes and the album title is Yes And. This is the debut record from Meg Duffy and Joel Ford. Meg Duffy, if you recognize the name, they have played with Kevin Morby for about, I think, two or three big tours, as well as Meg played pedal steel on, or no, slide guitar on the War on Drugs song Holding On. Is that correct? The third song off of Deeper Understanding?
Yes.
Yes. Meg is one of the best finger pickers and slide guitarists in the game. Joel Ford is a producer who has worked with Owen Trix Point Never, who is one of my absolute favorite producers and one of my absolute favorite musicians around right now. This record is gorgeous. I listened to this on my drive the other day through northern Arizona, and it combines two things I absolutely love. Kind of subtle melodic guitar finger picking and ambient atmospheric textures. This is a wheelhouse record for me. This is a very simple sell for me, but I highly recommend it to our listeners who like William Tyler, who liked the Yasmin Williams record from earlier this year. Really kind of if you're into atmospheric ambient soundscapes and finger picking lead guitar, and really among us indie jam heads, who is not? This is like all of our wheelhouse, if you will. Plus, it's two great artists. I highly recommend this. It's all instrumental. It's one of those great records that you can just throw on. It can be in the background as you're kind of making dinner, as you're doing some work, or it can be like a true headphone spin as you're taking a walk, you know, around the neighborhood in the evening type of thing, just trying to blow off some steam and, you know, kind of relax after a day. So highly, highly recommend Yes And's debut record, Yes And. Thank you.
So transitioning, we've been going back in time, going back every 5 years. We did 2011, 2006. Now we get to 2001 for classic summer albums. I think of the summer of 2001 very fondly because I was really feeling myself. I had just graduated from college. I was going to start law school in September of 2001. I was living in renting a room in a friend's apartment for the summer, and I think I had a temp gig as a proofreader, which I ostensibly did some proofreading, but I mostly just sat in a cubicle, listened to Widespread Panic, and probably skipped over tons of mistakes and stuff that I didn't do very well, but I got paid. It was fine. So, summer of 2001, I discovered the Beta Band. One of my roommates had a copy of the three EPs. I had never heard it until that summer. I was completely floored and flabbergasted by it. But fortunately, I think about 2 weeks after the three EPs came out, the second official Beta Band album, Hot Shots 2, was released. And my God, did I play the heck out of Hot Shots 2 in the summer of 2001. It's just a great record. I mean, the Beta Band, I think they only put out three official albums, not counting the three EPs. They had their self-titled, Hot Shots 2, and then Heroes to Zeros, which is clearly not as good as the other Beta Band albums. But yeah, I just, whenever I put on Hot Shots 2, it takes me right back to living in a tiny apartment room in New Brunswick, New Jersey in 2001. And I was going to go to law school. It was going to be September. Everything was going to be totally great. Of course, it was an innocent time. None of us really could have predicted what was going to happen in September of 2001 in New York City. But I made a fan of the Beta Band for life that summer. And that record still totally holds up. So Hot Shots Part 2. So, miles and miles.
Awesome. So when I think back to summer 2001, I was just finishing up my sophomore year in high school. I spent the summer working as a camp counselor at a camp in rural Wisconsin. And it was that summer that I was invited to the Trey Anastasio Band show at Alpine Valley. And I was given my first few Phish tapes, including 11/17/94. 9/14/99, 6/26/95, 10/7/2000. And I went through the summer just like completely obsessing over and getting into Phish in a way that still lingers today. The show at Alpine Valley, the Trey show, completely changed my life without no hyperbole there. It just completely, completely changed my life. Before that, though, I arrived at camp, at the summer camp I was working at, with a CD in tow that I listened to probably at least on a daily basis from my favorite band at the time, a CD that would never get the official release, but I think has long lived on as the last fantastic product from this band, and that is the Lilywhite Sessions from the Dave Matthews Band. So quick backstory. I'm sure a lot of you out there know kind of the history of it, but just to set the context, Dave Matthews Band releases Before These Crowded Streets in 1998. It's my personal favorite Dave Matthews Band record. It's a fantastic, peek into the band as they were evolving. Weird new sounds were coming into play. Their jamming was getting a lot better. Dave's songwriting was getting a little bit darker, a little bit moodier. They went on some huge tours in 98, 99, and 2000. I saw them at the end of 2000 and in early 2001. But during the summer and fall of 2000, they were recording these new tracks with Steve Lillywhite that as they were listening back to were realizing were incredibly dark and incredibly somber. During this time, Dave was going through some serious battles with alcoholism, and he was introduced by his record label to a producer named Glenn Ballard. They hung out. They apparently wrote like 12 songs in a week or something, recorded a bunch of demos. He brought them to the band, said, these are the songs that we're going to move forward with. They recorded an album called Every Day.
And it sucks.
The album sucks. Yeah. To put it plainly, it sucks. It's very pop heavy. It experiments in ways that just like sound like B-level versions of the Lily White session songs. And I remember as a fan being like really kind of pissed about the direction they were going in. And around that time, so now spring, early summer 2001, I get gifted a CDR that says a Lily White Sessions on it with 12 songs I've heard of slightly because they played them the previous fall, like Bartender, Gray Street, JTR. But I throw this album on and I'm just blown away by it. And myself, all my close friends were like, why is this not the record that was released? Why are we listening to this other album? And I listened to this record again on my car ride back from LA, and my wife and I were just like sitting in the car talking about how great it was and talking about like different moments that like preluded different areas of music that we both got interested in. It's a really moody record. It has like long extended outros, songs like JTR, Gray Street, Big Eyed Fish, Raven, Monkey Man, all are like, they just have this very interesting direction that I wish personally Dave Matthews Band had continued to go, and I probably would still listen to them as actively as I did then. But I highly recommend this. Our good friend Riley Walker did a reinterpretation of this in, I believe, 2018, and it's fascinating. He did an incredible job making a updated version of this with a few more jams off of it. It's a really fantastic snapshot of kind of what could have been. We talk a lot here about like what could have been with some of these bigger bands that we love. And I think that had this record kind of guided the band forward a little bit more, we could be in a different area or a different era for the Dave Matthews Band that I would personally enjoy a little bit more. So we're going to play a little bit off of the Lily White Sessions. It's a fantastic record.
Oh, I love to lie to myself, to say everything is fine now. I got to keep it up or fall behind. I got to keep it up or lose the edge we've found, drive faster. I build higher, still higher. I dig deeper down to what's down in the ground. It's found, used up, but then thrown now. Crazy, crazy little man, what do you think you're doing here?
I love the Lily White Sessions. Of note, I guess what they finally released in 2002 is Busted Stuff.
It's sanitized. It's like dulled around the edges. It's overproduced. Like obviously Lily White Sessions were kind of just like the sessions. So it hadn't been mastered yet, but there was something about those songs that kind of needed a more raw approach.
Yeah. Like they changed the lyrics to Gray Street. They added weird jazzy bass to Captain. Like it wasn't quite as good, but my law school roommate was obsessed with the Lily White Sessions, so I picked up a lot of it that way, and I was impressed. I'm like, oh, Dave Matthews guys, he's got more layers than I had once considered. But anyway, over here on the East Coast, looks like probably Fish is about to hit the stage in Deer Creek in about 5 minutes or so, and we want to watch that. So we're gonna get out of your way. We're going to hopefully have a fantastic run of Fish shows. There's Deer Creek, then Deer Creek, then Hershey in Atlantic City, and we're going to be chatting up about those, talking about some new records, talking about baseball and basketball, all these wonderful things. And if you hung to us at this point, thank you very much. Once again, thank you to Scotty King for coming on. And come back next Monday for The Drop.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.